Hey, this is Chris, and welcome to Module 2 of Design, Thinking, and Doing for Social Innovation. Each of the modules in this course is going to be framed by a question. And in this module, we're asking the question, what's the project? This podcast is coming to you from unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and future. First Nations peoples have been calling for their right to shape the policy and services that affect them at national and local levels. And a big theme in the second half of this module is about power and who gets to decide. In this module, we're starting at the start. So much of the potential for success or failure of a project that's using design methods is set up at the very start. Get a project set up well, decided an approach that's appropriate to the challenge in hand, and the process will almost run itself. But choose the wrong fit approach, and you could be building in bias, avoiding answering the questions that you really need to answer, or even trying to get results from design methods that they're just not going to give you. The first half of this module is going to be a 101 on the fundamentals of design thinking, assumptions, and the design process. The second half is all about the special considerations you need to make if you're using design thinking methods to work on complex social problems. And we're going to touch on the ever-present themes of power, inclusion, and trust.
Welcome to your channel, Ed. My name is BJ. Today, we are fortunate to speak to Sandra Hayes, director of the NGO Roundabout Water Solutions. Thank you for coming to Ed.
Thank you for joining us. No, great. Lovely to be here.
So, tell us more about Roundabout Water Solutions. What does the NGO do?
Roundabout Water Solutions is an NGO which is trying to provide clean drinking water to rural communities, preferably rural schools, where there's an existing borehole where we can put one of what we call our play pumps. Yeah. And the play pump is a children's merry-go-round that we place over the borehole. Then as the children play on it, it'll pump up clean drinking water.
So what need then did arise for you to get the come up with the play pump inventions?
Well, one of my colleagues was actually out in a rural area and he saw these children walking long distances to collect water from rivers. And he thought, wow, you know, the power of children, always wanting to play, these children be taken out of school, sent to collect water from rivers. What happens if we actually use that power of the children to bring up the water at their school? Yeah. He then met somewhere a farmer who had invented this play pump, and the idea was that put them into schools, so instead of the children going out of school, they've got something to play on, so that encourages them to go to school. They love playing on it, it's such fun.
Yeah.
And at the same time, without them really realizing it, they're actually pumping water.
So, last play pumps. Deep borehole down in an aquifer, joyful kids push a merry-go-round, pump water up into a tower, and everybody in the community has water. It's so seductive, and it's so wrong. And $20 million later, the party's over, and we don't even have any idea how many of these things are still spinning. So let's go through our little algorithm. Need, of course, everybody needs water. Does it work? We don't really know. We know that a lot of them broke down. There were all kinds of schemes to keep them going, but what we do know that didn't really work, but what we do know is that the aquifers are different and it doesn't work the same everywhere. And there are actually settings where kids would have to push this more than 24 hours a day to keep that full. And the last thing and the biggest thing was really, would they use it right? We all remember being on a merry-go-round when we were kids. We would use it every, it would be hot for a while, and then the swings are in. Or then some game, then jacks were in, and the merry-go-round would sit empty for a long time. And what it turned out was happening was that every time the foreigners with their cameras around, all the kids would rush over and start spinning this thing like crazy. as soon as they went, who was back turning it? It was the women. And we've got depressing footage of women trudging in a circle. And even we heard that they were taking the thing apart completely and putting reliable pump handles back on the thing. This was a bad idea.
So I want you to think of that time in your career when you thought you had a brilliant idea, something that you thought was going to be the best thing since sliced bread. But ultimately, it didn't work out as you thought. You could think of it as your play pumps moment. I think we've all got them. Mine was when I worked for Britain's biggest biscuit manufacturer in their innovation team. I was convinced that a roast beef Mars bar was a brilliant new idea for hungry men. All ideas, or hunches, or if you want to sound fancy, hypotheses, are based on the evidence we have at hand. That evidence may well be based in research, or as what has worked elsewhere in the past, or they may be purely informed by the life experiences and biases of the person or group that created them. For example, I would have eaten a roast beef Mars bar. But designing only from our perspective can get us into a lot of trouble when we're designing for complex social challenges, where often the people holding the funds and driving these innovation projects are quite different in terms of their life experience from the people we're ultimately trying to create outcomes for. Good research can help in these situations, but it's got its limits. Conventional research methods are always about the past and nearly always about what's worked in other contexts. And often, though not always, it's based in the problem rather than the solution. Yet if you're trying to address a social challenge, you're always interested in what's going to work for a particular group of people in a particular context in the future. And there's never any research about that. This is one of the main places where design methods can help. They can build on and extend existing conventional research methods and provide a rapid process to get a bridge into the future. They can't predict the future, but they can generate highly relevant knowledge about the very particular situations you're designing for and what's got a good chance of working. The key to avoiding your play pumps or roast beef Mars bar moments is to see everything as an assumption, and then to use a structured process to test and refine those assumptions as best you can in the resources available. We often don't see or aren't aware of our own assumptions, but if we've got an idea or a hunch of what might just work, a meat-based chocolate bar or a playground-based water pump, that's actually a stack of assumptions. Assumptions about the need for something different. Assumptions about the cause of that need, assumptions about the best strategy or solution to respond to that need, assumptions about how that strategy will create change, and assumptions about the enabling conditions for that strategy. Evaluators have fancy names for these different kinds of assumptions. They call them normative assumptions or diagnostic assumptions or prescriptive assumptions or causal assumptions and external assumptions. But design thinking can give you some of the tools to test all of those. In the next module, What Is, we'll give you tools to help test the assumptions about the need for something different and the cause of that need. And in the module, What If and What Works, we'll look at tools for testing the best strategy and how that strategy creates change.
Now I'm going to discuss how we would look for a new law. In general, we look for a new law by the following process. First, we guess it. Then we Well, don't laugh. That's really true. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see what, if this is right, if this law that we guessed is right, we see what it would imply. And then we compare those computation results to nature, or we say compare to experiment or experience. Compare it directly with observation to see if it works. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science. It doesn't make any difference how beautiful your guess is. It doesn't make any difference how smart you are who made the guess or what his name is. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. That's all there is to it. It's therefore not unscientific to take a guess, although many people who are not in science think it is.
Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression here. We have to make assumptions in this work. It's the only way we can make progress. But to paraphrase Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman, science is based on guessing. We just need to be honest with ourselves that we're doing that and putting good process to test those guesses and refine them. Practically speaking, testing assumptions in relation to social challenges means looping between in the office and out of the office work. In the office, wherever that is in 2022, we name and frame assumptions. Then we go out of the office to test them in the real world with community members. Design research methods and prototyping are two frequently used approaches to testing assumptions. Design research methods help you with what is questions and some of the what ifs, and prototyping helps you with the what if question and also what works. The more times we test and reframe our assumptions through real-world input, the more likely it is that our assumptions will fit reality. The more likely it is that we have an accurate understanding of life beyond the office and what will enable change in the community. Another way to think about this process is as a knowledge creation process. You start with a lot of uncertainty, and over time you reduce your uncertainty and increase your knowns. The design thinking and doing methods we'll cover in this course will give you the tools to do this work, to make sense of what is and identify opportunities, to creatively imagine new possibilities and select the most promising, and to develop ideas into functioning solutions. And these tools are going to work well with people in all their complexity, in the real world, in all of its complexity. And they can do all that relatively quickly and with a high degree of contextual relevance. But still, this can feel pretty rough and ready if you're used to more of formal approaches to research. And this work is not a replacement for that. It occupies a different space as that bridge to the future. But I'd argue that testing your assumptions through a staged process in the real world is significantly more rigorous and less risky than guessing what a solution is and then implementing that at scale without genuine testing of that solution, which is, of course, how too many social policies and programs are developed.
It has challenged me personally and professionally in every way a person could be challenged.
This is Carolyn Curtis talking about her first experience with design thinking and doing methods. This was when she worked on a prototype of a new service for families called Family by Family with Taxi. Then she was a secondment from Families SA into Taxi and... Now she's our CEO.
It's right from the start. I'm assessment versus ethnography and writing a policy versus co-design and piloting versus prototyping, throwing things out as quickly as you make them. It's just really starting from the bottom up, and I really understand now, and I think it's taken me the full 12 months, but I do really understand the potential that exists when you design and you create something with your end user versus creating something for them that you think will fit them best.
So next time you hear someone say, this is what we should do, think about the assumptions that that idea represents and start a conversation to unpack them. And think of the kind of in-the-office and out-of-the-office activity that could help test those assumptions. A good design process will help you rapidly test your assumptions in a cost-effective way. People think of design as a wild and crazy process, but a good design process is actually a good risk mitigation process, a process that spots incorrect assumptions early, before time and money is invested in implementing things that were never going to work, and at a stage where it's much easier and less costly and less embarrassing to make changes.
Diamonds are forever, are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever.
When I worked at the UK Design Council, one of my first projects was to work on creating an easy way to talk about the design process and design methods. We developed something then called the Double Diamond, and perhaps today it's one of the best known representations of the design process. Turns out we weren't the first people to think about using diamonds to describe a design process, and it's something that a lot of people have built on and improved since. And the Four Diamond Framework I'm going to share with you here is yet another adaptation and hopefully another improvement that builds on the improvements of others. So why diamonds? Design thinking and doing processes continually shift between opening up modes of thinking, divergent thinking, and closing down modes, convergent thinking. The opening up divergent thinking is the left-hand side of the diamond shape. The closing down convergent thinking, the right-hand side. String a whole bunch of diamonds together, and you've got a pretty good representation of a design process. Whilst the double diamond is famous for having two diamonds, the framework we developed behind it was always intended to be flexible. We had triple diamonds and quintuple diamond processes. And in this course, I'm going to use four, which match the four main modules of the course. What's the project? What is? What if? And what works? The first diamond is what's the project? Here, the opening up is about exploring what your assumptions are. What are the questions you need to answer? And what are the different ways you could go about answering them before deciding on an approach to answer them? Or even deciding that design isn't the most appropriate approach for the challenge at hand. So the divergent thinking is imagining all of the different ways you could do the project, and the convergent thinking is about choosing a preferred direction. And I think this diamond is critical because so much success or failure is set up at the very start of a design project. But this diamond rarely features in other design thinking frameworks. The second diamond is about what is. It's about understanding the current situation. You could start with some divergent exploration, for example, using design research methods to answer questions like, how do people in rural villages in Kenya actually get water now? And what do they think could be an improvement on that situation? Or, how do people snack at work? And what are their preferences around snacking at work? You'd ask those questions before moving on to some more convergent thinking. What are the opportunities to improve access to clean drinking water in Kenyan villages? Or what are the opportunities for a new snack that people will eat at work? The third diamond is about answering the question, what if? Here you get creative in responding to your newfound understanding of what is. You'll generate a number of potential responses. Ideas. What if we made a more robust hand pump for water? Or what if we improved maintenance regimes? Or what if we created a pump powered by children in a playground? What if we had a yummy, nutty protein cluster? Or a snack that clipped to a computer monitor? Another one of my brilliant ideas, by the way. Or a roast beef Mars bar? And now, because you've got that really solid understanding of what is, you stand a much better chance of judging what's got more potential. Because of the work that you've done in the what is phase, would you now choose a roundabout that pumps water or a more robust hand pump? Would you choose a roast beef Mars bar or a yummy, nutty protein ball? The fourth diamond is about answering the question, what works? This could start in a lab, divergently experimenting with a number of different ways to make a hand pump more robust. Or it could start by baking small batches of protein balls in the test kitchen to work out what recipe is the most yummy. Then, to narrow down those options, you might test the pump in the field for a day, or the yummy nutty protein clusters at your colleague's desk or at a focus group. Practically, the what works diamond is often repeated many times in increasingly more lifelike settings as the ideas themselves become more mature. After developing a robust hand pump in the lab, you might install it in a Kenyan village for a month and compare it with the alternatives. After developing your yummy nutty protein balls in the test kitchen and in focus groups, you might launch a new product in a test market for a few months to see what sales are like.
We've been trying to answer who is this for? Who are the right families? What are the right cohort of families? We've been trying to understand what are the right activities that happen in a connection to actually see change occur. How does change happen? How can we design tools that enable change? What are the right rhythms and flows for a professional to come in and out of a connection? How do we hold risk?
This is Daniel Abbott from Taxi explaining the questions that were the focus of the What Works phase for a service that we designed called the Virtual Village. It's a service that connects women who have experienced violence with women currently experiencing violence to provide support during the COVID lockdown.
Is the digital way the right way? Who are the right? At what point do we ask a referrer to step in? We've asked so many questions. Sorry, it's 12 weeks of questions, and so like, and at the end of every kind of we operated in 2 week sprints. So at the end of every 2 week sprint, we looked back on the questions we'd asked in that 2 weeks, and we asked ourselves, have we answered these questions? Do we have a good idea of a way forward here? Was it the wrong question? Do we have new questions that have arisen across this time? And we were iterating in those 2 weeks sprints across the 12-week prototype.
In Module 5, we'll talk a little bit more about what happens beyond prototyping. But where the What Works diamond stops and implementation for real and at scale starts is really going to depend on what you're designing, the setting you're working in, the resources you have to hand, and requirements and norms around levels of evidence generated in this kind of work to go on to the next stage. So, some caveats. The four diamonds here are represented as four things that neatly happen sequentially with equal emphasis. The diagram's a lot neater that way. But in practice, these things overlap. Diamonds are often repeated. Some diamonds take longer than others, and you can be in multiple places at once. For example, when conducting what is work, it often makes complete sense to explore with people what ifs or what could be. This is going to give you insight into the situation and potential solutions at the same time, even though you didn't get to the what if stage yet. We've already talked about how the what works stage is often repeated as ideas mature. But you might also decide to repeat a what is stage, for example, if you didn't get enough information to answer the questions you wanted to answer, or even a what if stage if the ideas that you created were not up to scratch. For an experienced practitioner, a what's the project stage may just take a few hours or an afternoon. But even for an experienced practitioner, the what works diamonds could play out over weeks or months or years. Say, for example, you generate a completely out-of-the-box idea in a what-if stage, something you hadn't even thought was on the table before. You might find yourself needing to add a mini what-is project to understand that context more deeply. So think of these diamonds as a process diagram, but also the individual diamonds as building blocks for designing a good design thinking and doing project. The best combination is going to be the combination that works in the setting that you're working in. And a final note on the diamonds and a bit of a word of warning. The diamonds, like everything else we're sharing in this course, are intended to build capability in design thinking and doing. They're not necessarily the best way to talk about design thinking inside of your organization or externally. Just like the outputs of a design process, the design process itself needs to fit well with the context that you're working in. And working out how to talk about it in your context while staying coherent to the principles of the approach is always something to be thought about. As a bit of inspiration on that point, here's Auntie Vicky Charles, our auntie in residence, our Aboriginal lead and chief caller of bullshit, or as she calls it, wanky white language, sharing how she explains the design process to Aboriginal community members using the stepping stones framework that we developed together. Same concepts, but a different way to tell the story.
Language is such a big thing that really got me, because I'm a deep thinker, but I'm really simple when I talk and explain things. And I often think, wow, that's just a really, and I'll be really straight here, a white way of saying stuff. And I sit there and I go, "How? If I'm supposed to explain that to someone else, how do I use my words to be able to do that?" And so, this is what sort of Chris created the stepping stones in a joking manner, but we thought it was a great idea. So we had we have the community led, say on the riverbank, and then we have in the taxi language of setting foundations. So when I talk about stepping, the setting foundations, I actually say this in my words. So I say that's what I call the relationship building stage. And then when we talk about learning what and understand what helps and hinders, I say that is yarning with a purpose. So I go and have a yarn and I do it purposefully. So we just sit and talk like we are now, but there's all this information that gets gathered from that yarn instead of doing a tick and flick survey or a, so. And then we have exploring opportunities and solutions. So then we find out from the yarn, we work out what opportunities and or solutions. So basically, that's understanding the yarn, what's come from the conversation. And then we test what works in the real world, so intentional trial and error, I call that. So going out and actually testing. And then spread, share and grow is, I don't even know. I just call it spread, share and grow as well. But the whole time that we're doing any of these steps, that we're actually making sure that we're feeding in and out of the community and making sure we're still building the trust, that it's still co-designed, that it's building capability and that intellectual property is held. So that was sort of a joint thing that we used after we had the principles, and because I was trying to think how can I explain that double diamond process with, like, in my words? Because I think if I can't understand it, how is anyone else going to understand what I'm trying to tell them and talk about?
Thousands have marched through the city in an emotional show of Aboriginal pride. They're demanding the state government commits to a treaty they say will give them a voice.
Celebrating Aboriginal history with smoke ceremonies, dance, paint and music. Thousands hope for a new tradition, respect.
I want people to learn and respect our culture and understand our struggles.
The Aboriginal people are still here, we're still strong.
This land they call Australia is Aboriginal land.
They marched 3 kilometres from Fitzroy to Federation Square as part of the annual NAIDOC Week. Stopping outside State Parliament for speeches about Aboriginal rights and Aboriginal deaths in custody.
Our people are dying and we need to come together and make sure that we're the ones that put an end to it.
Despite being the target of some protesters' anger, police joined in too.
To show the support from the police to the Aboriginal community, help repair our relationships.
They stopped at major intersections, pushing for a treaty with the Victorian government.
A treaty should be a thing. It should already be happening. It's ridiculous it hasn't already happened.
The theme for this year's NAIDOC Week is voice, treaty, truth. But possibly their greatest underlying issue has been an ongoing struggle for decades, land rights.
Always was, always will be!
Well, you need to listen to us, hey? We need our treaty. We need our land back.
Everything we've covered so far is Design Thinking 101. There are hundreds of books on the topic and lots of courses, and it's all relevant to social innovation. But we can't go any further without really unpacking the complex themes of power, participation, and trust. Because if you're going to use design thinking in social settings, you're going to be walking right into this space. What we've done so far is pretty concrete. Here, we're going to get into the grey. Depending on how you use them, design thinking and doing methods can reinforce existing power dynamics, or they can be part of resetting them. Design thinking and doing done well can form new relationships of trust and understanding between people and institutions. But done poorly, they can widen the gap. Whether design thinking contributes to bringing people and institutions closer together, or becomes a wedge that drives people and institutions further apart, will all depend on how people with lived experience are involved in the process, the quality of the process, and the level of influence that people have on the outcome, and the authenticity and transparency within which all of this is conducted. The clarion call from many groups who are marginalised are that policy and services don't work for them because they were not created for them or by them. Design thinking and doing methods offers a practical way to do that. The iconic feature of design methods are that they enable people most affected by a given situation to shape the understanding of the current situation and influence what's designed in response to that. The degree of influence and the degree of participation varies between projects, but to be effective, it needs to be coherent with the situation at hand. And that's easy to get wrong. Involve people most affected by the situation too little, and you risk getting only incremental solutions at best, harmful solutions at worst. Certain groups will be vocal about being excluded, but your approach will probably fit well with your business as usual. Involve people too much, more than you have the capability and capacity and conditions to support, and you risk not getting an outcome, causing harm through your process, and power clashes within your organisation. And that's a pretty easy way to get burnt out. Involve people to the greatest extent that you have conditions and capability to support, and do that authentically, and you'll get the most creative and relevant solution possible without major disruption and within your resources. Involve people in any process that seems more ambitious or more participatory than it actually is, and you're going to quite rightly get shot down for it. The range of ways that people most impacted by decisions can be authentically involved in design-based processes is a spectrum that ranges from, on one hand, building empathy, to, on the other hand, they make all the decisions. At their least participatory, design thinking processes can involve using methods to bring people into the room. For example, building personas, descriptions that represent people based on what the design team already know, and decision-making processes that preference what would work for the people most affected by this decision. This is a step up from not thinking about people at all, but it's very risky, as your assumptions are based on your worldview and will include bias, for example, unintended racial or gender bias. In most cases, I wouldn't recommend this approach unless you are designing for somebody like you, you already have a deep understanding of people's needs and preferences, or this is the best that can be done in the constraints available. the next step along the spectrum of participation is to take a consultative approach, to keep reaching out throughout your project to understand people's lives, to develop ideas, to get feedback on solutions, and to test what works with them. Practically, this often means moving between working in the office and in people's homes or workplaces or community settings. This is a typical human-centered design approach. It's fast, efficient, and fits well with business as usual. And it's an approach we often use at Taxi. It's the kind of approach that we use to develop Family by Family that you heard Carolyn talking about earlier, and you'll hear more about in the next episode. But the power in this still sits with the design team. People most affected get to voice their preferences and concerns, and if the team is good, they will listen and change the project in response to those, but the people most affected don't get to decide. Human-centered design processes can create real value, and often they're the deepest level of participation government can deal with without real organisational challenges, because human-centered design processes do not transform power relationships. And it's because power relations are not transformed that many groups are critical of human-centered design processes. Groups that have experienced harms through policy, services, or consultations are demanding and expecting more. In Australia today, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, mental health consumers, and people living with disability, to name a few, are all demanding their right to self-determination. They say, in different words, nothing about us without us, and in certain situations, bias for us. They represent a much bigger group of people who public systems frequently fail. We could include parents in contact with the child protection system, or kids in schools that aren't really working for them, or people leaving prison, or women experiencing violence. In our view, where there is ambition and resources, moving beyond consultative approaches like human-centered design into participatory design approaches is much more appropriate because they are more just. Whilst the spiritual home of design thinking is the Silicon Valley boardroom, participatory design has its roots in the union movement in Scandinavia, where workers and managers collaborated to develop better working environments to their mutual benefit and to the benefit of their organisations. In participatory processes, power is deliberately balanced between those most affected and other stakeholders. In the most complete expression of a participatory process, people most affected by a situation co-plan the project, make the sense of the current situation together with professionals in the team, develop ideas together, and then prototype them. People and professionals are in the room together making those tough decisions. Participatory projects use all of the same methods we'll cover here to conduct research and to do prototyping. But they also have to employ additional strategies to balance power. This can include thinking about the numbers involved in the room, how information is presented, how the project is governed, how responsibilities are distributed, how professionals are supported to step in and out of their own power, and people most affected the same. Here's Daniel Abbott again, from Taxi, explaining the participatory design approach that was used to make decisions for the prototyping of the virtual village service.
Sure, so the virtual village is a peer-to-peer virtual support program where we take volunteers with lived experience of domestic violence, drug and alcohol misuse or homelessness, and we connect them to somebody who is isolated and is either currently or has recently left domestic violence, homelessness or drug and alcohol misuse. In partnership with Uniting Communities and also with Department of Human Services. So what we did is we formed a co-design group out of those partners that was made up of both practitioners and people who would be potentially be delivering a service like this, families and the families who would be receiving or volunteering on a service like this, and also referrers and people who would see value in referring families that they knew were struggling into a service like this. So we formed that group, And we met with that group weekly, and every week we brought different challenges to that group and really openly kind of discussed or role-played, tried ideas that would be helpful, not just for the families, but for the people who were sitting around supporting those families. So the families were able to say, no, that wouldn't work. That's a terrible idea. Families will never do that because of whatever. But also practitioners will say, well, that really doesn't work for us as a system. There's no way we could do that. And we were able to use that information to find a middle ground, but B, ideas to just test live and quickly to see if they would work if we were to put them into the room.
Participatory design projects need a high degree of customization for different settings. For example, the considerations to bring together people living with non-verbal disabilities and NDIA bureaucrats to design a new policy would be a different approach to how you might productively bring together people with lived experience of being forcibly restrained in mental health settings and the nurses and psychologists who do that as part of their day-to-day responsibilities.
I'm here with Lucy Fraser from TACSI. When you're working with diverse communities, as you have been with the South Sudanese Australian community, how do you set up projects like that for success when you're not from that community yourself?
I think being really open and honest about that is a good start, to just acknowledge that you aren't from that community and that you can't represent that community, and that it's not one community but many. Mm. I think one of the important things is to really do your homework and make sure that you can understand what's already known about some of the sort of challenges and opportunities and strengths of that particular cultural group, so that you're not going in and asking questions that researchers or designers might have asked before. And so you're sort of letting people know that you've listened to what they've already said, and you want to build on that. I think another one is to be really clear on what value you can offer, so that you're not being purely extractive. You're not going into communities and networks to just purely learn from them, but you can also offer them opportunities for skill development or paid roles or the opportunity to broadcast their story to a wider audience. Or there are many things that people might find valuable from your engagement with them. I think it's important to work alongside community members, so building relationships with people who are in a position where they can comfortably walk between two worlds and be a sort of element of cultural safety when you might go into talk to people and things like that, that they can be a guide, a cultural guide, or even better, they can ask those questions themselves and sort of share with you the outcomes.
Now, I wonder if there's times that you feel you've sort of stuffed up in kind of engaging appropriately with diverse communities. I don't know if there's some stories that you'd be willing to share for the benefit of others there.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, you're always going to stuff up. I think that's something you need to be ready for and know that you need to figure that out when you do that and say sorry and do what needs to be done to be able to sustain those relationships. I think some times that I've stuffed up have probably been when I've had a few assumptions about what the people that I was trying to work with wanted and the kind of involvement that they'd like to have in a project based on what I needed from them. So probably going in a bit too with too much of a clear idea of what I wanted, and saying this is what you'd have to do, rather than having a conversation with someone and saying, you know, we're doing this project, we'd love some help with this, here are our gaps, what do you think you can help with?
I think a bit of a theme through your projects is you've really been creating roles for people that are from the community. Can you say a little bit about sort of how you thought about shaping those roles, the kinds of roles they are, and sort of how you go about setting them up as well?
In the first project we had peer researcher roles where it was really alongside role where we were sort of doing work with people. So we would go do interviews together and then we'd do analysis together. And I think, you know, because we then learned a lot and we had these strong relationships in this project, we were able to push that a little bit further and have roles that were a bit more independent, and sort of have support that's more behind the scenes and trying to find people to lead pieces of work. Yeah, so different roles for different kinds of projects and as relationships evolve over time.
You know, I think it's important in these things to make some abstract concepts concrete. So things like sharing power. I wonder if you could just talk, like, what does that look like for a white organisation, for example, that might be sitting with the funding? Like, what do they do?
So I think that there are lots of inherent things in the design of this project that do share power. And that's probably one of the reasons that we are doing this work, because that's what CoHealth was looking for. So I think things like taking a co-design approach, that's sharing power already. Also to have a governance group with a majority from the communities, that's sharing power too. We have, I guess on an individual level, people are needing to reflect on their own power and privilege and how they can set themselves up for working with that and sharing that in meetings. So there is the need to call each other out sometimes on things or behaviour where we might be holding our own power and not realising it, or like keeping people out of a conversation or things like that. So there is a really open dialogue where we're constantly checking in with each other. You know, I'm often contacting CoHealth and saying, hey, you know, I'm thinking of doing it this way. What do you think? Do you feel comfortable with that? And I'm talking to community members and saying, hey, we're thinking of doing it this way. What do you think about that? And sort of being a bit of a conduit between the two to find an approach that sort of is doable, but also is respecting people's culture and identity. And I think, you know, CoHealth is, they have really strong values that are aligned to power sharing. And, you know, they've been able to call me out a couple of times to say like, okay, we can actually do better than that, and push me to, and our team to be better at sharing power.
The final points on the spectrum of participation we could call self-determined design. This is where people most affected or communities are given the time, money, responsibility, and capability to design their own solutions. For this to work, people have got to want to do that. And this is what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and their allies have been fighting for decades. It's the long-term ambition that many of the mental health consumer movement have. And it's what TACSI are currently doing in towns across Australia. We're building the capability of 6 South Australian rural towns to self-determine their own well-being. This is the town team from Mid-Murray, talking about what they see as the value of leading their own design process.
Communities are the experts in what's going on in their lives, in their communities, with their children, with their parents, whatever. And we need to listen to that, you know. And I think if people are leading something, they're more invested. If it's just another group coming in saying, oh, let's do this, you know. So by making it community-led, they've got ownership of it, they've got investment, they're activated, you know, they're mobilised to create that change for themselves.
Experience overall was really good. I felt really included by the team, and we felt that we had some really good insights gained from community consultation, and we have some really good ideas going forward, so we're excited about that.
I've noticed a real mindset shift with all of our region, or the bulk of our region, around we can do stuff for ourselves rather than council need to do this, services need to, schools need to, you know, whatever it might be. It's something that I've really seen over the last year. Initially it was, we can't respond to mental health, we don't have any services, whereas now they're kind of going, actually, what can we do? You know, so that real mindset shift has been a real learning curve, I think, for all of us across that community.
My vision would be around the connectedness of the town and the communities, from the sporting club to the school to the caravan park to the pub, just working together with a common understanding and a common language that really promotes well-being from birth.
We recommend participatory and self-determined approaches where the conditions are there or can be created, but we won't have time to go into them in depth in this course. But Everything you learn in this course is relevant to those settings. And in fact, one common shortfall of participatory and self-determined processes is that they don't pay enough attention to the fundamentals of design thinking and doing. And I think many of them will be much stronger if they did. Now, I'm very happy to have got so far in this course without mentioning the C word, co-design. There's great noise and excitement about the concept of co-design in Australia. You'll see it used in mental health, in Indigenous services, and wildly used, widely, and perhaps wildly, used by the service sector. Now, on one hand, this is really helpful because there's a great potential in collaborative design processes, and this is, of course, what this course is all about. But it's unhelpful because co-design is not just one thing, it's many, and the concept is poorly understood, especially the design bit of it. And of course, some governments and services are simply relabeled consultation processes, co-design processes. Professor Megan Davis, a constitutional lawyer and one of the architects of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, went so far as to describe co-design as a bureaucratic buzzword void of any real meaning. Thankfully, I think this is starting to change in a few places where the commitment to co-design is genuine, even if the conditions and capabilities to do it well are embryonic. So what's a good design thinking and doing project? Well, in a good design thinking and doing project, a number of things need to triangulate. The complexity and power dynamics of the situation, the ambition for change, the capability for delivering design thinking and doing methods, the depth of participation, the budget, the authenticity and transparency, and the follow-through post-design and prototyping. If, for example, you go after a big challenge with a narrative that you're going to make radical change without the capability and budget and commitment to do that, you're setting yourself up for failure. But go after the same challenge with the same resources and an honesty that you're trying to learn and expecting to only make a small improvement, and you'll get much better results and engagement. Tell people or a service sector that they have a chance to influence change when they don't get to make the decision, or the minister is likely to intervene, and you're going to have egg on your face. Set out in a participatory process without training, and you could make things worse. Set out on the same project with a consultative approach, and you could go much better. Take the time to build the capability for a participatory approach, and you could see your relationship with people and outcomes transform through a very different way of seeing the situation. So I've spent a lot of time telling you about the value of design thinking and doing. Design methods are pretty versatile, but they're not always the best fit. They're not going to work well when the decision is already made, where there's not an openness to learning, where there isn't the capability or resources to do them well, or if decisions are only made on the basis of academic level evidence. I also think that design should not be the dominant methodology or process if it's a question of deciding between competing value sets, or if you're trying to transform a whole system. For example, when you're exploring questions of conflicting values, e.g., should we have a nuclear waste facility in our state, or how should we allocate the city budget over the next decade? Deliberative methods such as citizens' juries or participatory budgeting are a much better dominant methodology, as they provide for learning and making trade-offs between groups of people in the way that design doesn't. Challenges of systems transformation, for example, what's the next paradigm of child protection services, or what is the future of end of life in Australia? While questions of this time are much better suited to the many systems change methodologies, such as the four-step process or Theory U or systemic impact networks, because they are designed to take into account the complexity of systems and the role of multiple stakeholders in creating change. But this is not to say that design can't add value in either of these situations. Values conflict and systems transformation type processes I think would both be richer if design methods were incorporated to improve their understanding of the current situation and to creatively explore alternative futures. You can be confident in choosing a design thinking and doing approach if you're at the very start of an innovation journey. If you're creating something tangible, for example, a space or a product or something digital. If you need a breakthrough solution different to what's been tried before, design research methods will help you identify new opportunities and develop creative solutions. I think design thinking and doing can be really interesting if you're intending to scale across multiple locations, because then there's a strong case for getting your assumptions accurate early and at a small scale and not scaling flawed assumptions. Design methods fit well if success or failure will be determined by the behaviour of individuals or groups, and that's highly contextual because design can create that new evidence rapidly where it doesn't already exist. Design works well if you want to include the expertise of lived experience in your process, because design methods give you a practical ways to do that, particularly participatory and self-determined approaches. Design methods are a good fit if you're pursuing a co-production agenda, because design gives you a participatory way to design co-produced services. And I think design is a good choice if you're looking for a repeatable and versatile way of doing innovation. And there are some non-obvious or even surprising uses of design, most of them to do with when you're working with things that are not totally new. Because design methods are about understanding value or not, they can be a really good way to inform what to stop doing. Design methods can help you make choices between options that already exist. For example, do I choose if model A or model B is a better fit for context? Or how would I adopt model A for a context incorporating aspects of model B that seem to work well? Design research methods can be used as a form of evaluation, especially if you're focused on identifying opportunities for improvement. And design methods can be used in day-to-day office work, planning and facilitating meetings, for example. I do that all the time. And design doesn't have to start from a blank slate. If there's a clear hunch as to what a solution is, using design methods to test assumptions that people are already bought into can help validate and refine them if they are right, or shift them if they are wrong. So I'm going to end each of these modules with a set of questions that you can use to judge whether you're doing good design thinking and doing or not. And so for this module, they're all about the project. There are a few of them, but they're all written down in the course deck, along with accompanying visuals and further references for everything that I've been talking about in this module. So how do you know if you're doing a good design project? Well, are you naming your assumptions and questions at different levels? Assumptions about the need, the problem, the solution, how the solution will work, and any external factors that will affect the solution. Are you naming your assumptions upfront about your target groups and outcomes and your constraints? Are you considering issues of power and authenticity and giving those most affected by an issue a genuine opportunity to influence how you understand the problem and potential solutions and what works? Are you choosing an approach that triangulates the complexity and power dynamics of the situation with your ambition for change, your capability, the depth of participation you'll take, the budget, authenticity and transparency that you can embrace, and the follow-through post-design? And are you structuring a process that includes time, resources, and methods to discover what is, create what ifs, and develop what works?